In Irish eyes, America has always been the promised land, the dreamscape, a paradise on earth. At the end of The Great Gatsby, Fitzgerald imagines the first sailors to ever come to New York. He wonders what they made of this fresh, green breast of the New World, and decides that, for a transitory, enchanted moment, man must have held his breath in the presence of this continent, compelled into an aesthetic contemplation he neither understood nor desired, face to face for the last time in history with something commensurate to his capacity for wonder. New York still inspires something like wonder, but not for its resemblance to paradise. Now it's the opposite, a testimony to the works not of God, but man. Flying from Belfast back to Newark, the plane makes landfall in Canada and turns south, following the Hudson through the pristine wilderness. The enormous river, glinting in the sun, unspools through the Adirondacks and Catskill Mountains, fleecy with unbroken forest. Reservoirs and lakes dot the landscape like shards of a mirror. As the plane flies downstate, the natural scenery of soft-edged greens and browns and blues start to give way to small scattered towns, and suddenly, in the distance, New York City rises up, unlikely and boxy, all grey and silver and glass. I first came to America on holiday with my parents and sister when I was 9. We stayed in East Village with my father's second cousin, Sandy, who was, and still is, a window dresser. I was much more shocked at the size of his one-bedroom apartment than the fact that he lived with a man. His partner, Stephen, had the wherewithal to clear out before the descent of Irish relatives, so we never met him. But we pitched camp in his living room, and I slept with my feet in his kitchenette. Knowing what I know now about NYC apartments, it was a pretty roomy one-bedroom. But I'd grown up surrounded by fields. Space was what we had, though horizontal space, not vertical. My only experience of a tall building then was a block of council flats in East Belfast that my great-uncle Jack and Auntie Daisy lived in, though they were on the second floor. I remember the vertical axis of New York's architecture left me a bit overwhelmed. Walking along the street is like walking along a man-made canyon. The sky is in strips far above you, and for a kid from the sticks, the huge influx of people of all different shapes and sizes and colours was fascinating and also frightening. Part of the weirdness one experiences visiting New York for the first time is that the place is also very familiar in some way. You've seen it in 1,000 movies. And now you're walking down the film set. Actually, with the amount of filming done in Manhattan, there's a good chance that you might find you're on an actual set. There's the steam rising from the manhole covers, just like in Ghostbusters. There's the Washington Square Arch, where Billy Crystal drops off Meg Ryan and When Harry Met Sally. There's the Empire State Building, though lacking King Kong, and here's 34th Street and Macy's, where miracles occur. Here's the Museum of Natural History from the Night at the Museum, and so on. New York is so distinctive and so represented in popular culture that there's a kind of hyper-reality to it, a kind of merging of real life and its simulation. Though I've lived in cities now for almost half my life, in London and Warsaw and Rome, and New York, and can cope in them for months at a time. At some point, I need to see a flat expanse of grass, some cows, a forest, an ocean, a night sky not stripped of stars by light pollution. If I can go a bit metaphysical here, there needs to be an interaction with the natural, with the wordless, with the infinite. And you needed to relegate the daily drama of your own life to the tiny corner it actually deserves. The other time I visited America when I was younger was in 1992, when I was 16, and spent 3 weeks in Chicago. Four of us had won an essay competition, a girl from Cork, one from Belfast, a guy from Monaghan, and me from Cookstown. And stayed with lovely host families in Highland Park, a wealthy suburb off the city, eating cheesy fries, and since the trip was meant to be a study of conflict, meeting gang members who had lost friends or killed people. In Chicago, I found myself being asked about how the freedom fighting was going on in the old country. Since the essay I'd written for the competition was about the Troubles and how the IRA had just murdered a friend of mine, a barman I worked with, this wasn't really up my street. I was sitting in our living room when I heard the bomb go off that killed him. But how do you explain this in context of the IRA's freedom fighting? Early on, I realized that the American attitude to the Irish narrative, or Irish narratives, was reductionist. That the complicated facts on the ground were reduced to a load of schematic diagrams and simplistic lies. In retrospect, I think my behavior during that trip, I'd tell host families that with no TVs in our country, that most people still rode a horse and trap, was my own adolescent way of rewriting and thus defusing the narratives about Ireland. It's also possible that I was just a wind-up artist. In 1938, in Autumn Journal, the poet Louis MacNeice asked, why do we like being Irish? Partly because it gives us a hold on the sentimental English as members of a world that never was baptised with fairy water. We might add that that hold is exerted on the Americans too. The Irish are regarded as an atavistic, almost magical race. All those stories of the wee folk and the land of Tiernan Og, of charms and cures and wishing trees, of t-shirts declaring that there are two kinds of people in the world, those who are Irish and those who want to be, of hats saying, kiss me, I'm Irish. The last time I sat at the gate at Newark, waiting to board, a young couple looking at their new guidebook were discussing their itinerary. The man said how it seemed like there was a castle in every field in Ireland. The country exists as an idea in America, an old, almost medieval world removed from modern life, and that imaginative structure is reversed. America exists still in the Irish imagination, modern, meritocratic, huge, and hugely wealthy. The Irish have been coming to America forever. In the 1700s, it was mostly Irish Protestants who made the trip. And they struck out west in search of land and colonized vast swathes of the central southern states. Irish Catholics started coming in mass later, during the 1800s. And they tended to cluster in cities along the northeast coast. New York, Boston, Philadelphia. The immigration from Ireland went up several gears. Potato crops began to fail. And during the Great Famine, between 1845 and 1852, hundreds of my ancestors, Kingstons and Shannons from Cork, Lairds from Donegal, Funstons and Stewarts, and Blunts and Sweetnams, were processed through Ellis Island. Some were Catholic, most were Protestant. All were poor and ready to start again. The Irish also brought with them their sectarianism, which they liked to carry everywhere like a pocket watch. In 1870 and 1871, the Orange Riots occurred in New York, in which more than 100 people died. The rioting followed the banning, and then the unbanning of a 12th of July march down through Manhattan, a kind of precursor to drunkery. One of the reasons I love New York is that it allows you, if you want, to leave nationality behind. My own relationship with that is complicated. I'm Irish, but that seems an oversimplification. I'm also British, though people might think one invalidates the other. But it was British taxpayer money that put me through an English university and paid for my schooling in Cookstown. This idea that you can't be plural is nonsense. The human is not binary. It's like speaking French. If I can speak French, does it mean I can't speak German? I can't, as it happens, speak either. But singular ideas of nationalism are a dangerous thing, as the Northern Irish learnt. And the things done in the names of Britain and Ireland are so often repulsive that any identification with a country has to be qualified by a disgust as to how it operates. Easier to consider myself a citizen of Tyrone, with a large helping of Donegal and Armagh and a little of Corkthorpe. To take a strenuous position on anything involving nationality seems a bit ludicrous, too abstract. Although declaring myself Irish, when friends and relatives were injured or killed by the IRA to ensure a declaration, but you need a passport to get in and out of places. So, to that end, I went the way of my parents and have both Irish and British ones. Although New York is not the Irish town it once was, Irishness still has a certain currency here. The Irish Arts Centre on 51st Street runs Irish language classes, which I sporadically attend, and an Irish poetry festival, as well as hosting Irish plays and musical performances throughout the year. There are Irish writers living in the town, the two columns.